This is Fresh Air. Terry Gross is under the weather today. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for her. Last June, millions of people who know and care nothing about golf were mesmerized by the final round battle at the U.S. Open, played at the Torrey Pines Golf Course in San Diego. The world's best, Tiger Woods, was playing with a torn knee ligament that inflicted such pain that he cried out in agony and bent over after several swings. But just as compelling a figure was Woods' adversary, a paunchy 45-year-old journeyman from the tour with a regular guy look and the unlikely name of Rocco Mediate. It was a script that could have been written in Hollywood. Woods had won 13 major tournaments. Mediate, though a respectable golfer when healthy, had none. Woods was trim and muscular. Mediate looked like the guy next door. Woods walked the course in resolute silence. Mediate grinned and chattered incessantly. Mediate battled Woods to a draw, setting up an 18-hole playoff the following day. Woods eventually prevailed, and my guest John Feinstein says the match was so intensely followed that trading on Wall Street plummeted during its final 2 hours. Mediate has joined with Feinstein to write a memoir and account of the battle called Are You Kidding Me? A little later we'll speak with Rocco Mediate. First, John Feinstein. He's a regular contributor to Morning Edition and the author of more than a dozen sports books, as well as 3 sports mystery novels for young readers. He also writes for The Washington Post and Golf Digest. Well, John Feinstein, welcome to Fresh Air. This book is about this epic battle between Tiger Woods, the best golfer anybody's ever seen, and this wonderful, affable 45-year-old Rocco Mediate, who, when this tournament began, was, I think you write, the 158th ranked player in the world. When this tournament began, was he even on your radar?
I don't think he was on anybody's radar except his own, Dave. I think that the great thing about golf is that stories like this do happen on occasion. And in Rocco's case, he was someone who had been a good player, not a great player, but a good player, when healthy. And those two words were kind of the key to his career and to his life. He'd had back problems dating back to the early 1990s. He'd had back surgery in 1994. He'd had issues with the back on and off ever since then, and had finally felt healthy for about a year leading into this Open. But he still had to go through a qualifier just to get to play. Each year at the U.S. Open, there are only about 60 to 70 players who are exempt into the tournament. In other words, Tiger Woods doesn't have to qualify. He just shows up and plays. But most players among the 156 who are in the field on the first day have to go through these qualifiers. And Rocco, because his ranking in the world was 158th, as you mentioned, had to actually play in a 36-hole qualifier. I think there were 23 spots available at this particular qualifier, and there were 139 players. And they had to play 36 holes in one day. At the end of the 36 holes, Rocco was in an 11-way tie for 17th place, which meant that those 11 players had to go off and play sudden death for the final 6 spots in the field. First player to make a birdie, or one of the first 6 players to make a birdie, would qualify. You make a bogey, you're probably out. And Rocco, fortunately, as the sun was setting, because it's a long day at those qualifiers, made a birdie at the first of the playoff holes. He was the only one of the 11 players to make a birdie and thus qualified to get to play. That got him into the Open.
And when we remind us, birdie and bogey, just for golf newcomers.
For those who aren't familiar with golf, each hole is assigned a par depending on its length. It's either a par 3, a par 4, or a par 5. If you score underneath the par score, that's called a birdie. If you're 2 shots under the par score, it's an eagle. If you score 1 shot over whatever the par number is, it's a bogey. And if you're 2 over, it's a double bogey, and 3 over, a triple bogey, and so on.
Now, you write about Tiger Woods. Everybody knows he's, you know, sort of unmatched, alone and apart in, among golfers. Talk a little bit about what he was like when he first appeared, and in particular his relationship with other players and with the media, the kind of posture he struck.
Well, when Tiger first came on tour late in 1996, there was almost a Tiger zone that very few people entered, whether he was in the locker room or on the driving range or anywhere at a golf tournament. The only people who regularly entered that zone were his agents, his family, his swing coach, his caddy, and maybe one or two other close friends. And most of the other players on tour were either intimidated by him because he was such a big star when he arrived on tour, or jealous of him because he was such a big star when he arrived on tour. And he was a 20-year-old kid who, as great as his golf was still learning his way on the tour the way anybody in a new job has to learn their way. One of the few people who was not either jealous or intimidated by Tiger Woods was Rocco Mediate. Rocco remembered when he first came on tour. Now, he wasn't a star by any means when he came on tour, but he remembered older players like Tom Weisskopf and Raymond Floyd and Curtis Strange, who sort of reached out to him and said, look, kid, this is how you do it. This is how you don't do it, because he didn't know.
And what did he tell him? What was something that Tiger needed to learn?
Well, what Tiger needed to learn, for one thing, was how to communicate with the other pros, because he really didn't know how. He had lived in this cocoon of stardom from the time he was a teenager. He won the U.S. Junior Championship when he was 15 years old, youngest player in history to do it. He won the U.S. Amateur when he was 18 years old, youngest player in history to do it. He'd gone to Stanford for 2 years. So he had some sense of how to socialize in college, but now not how to socialize in a locker room with other guys who were his peers or his elders. And Rocco was one of the guys who said, look, this is what we do. He kind of helped him assimilate into the PGA Tour, which wasn't as easy as you might think it would be for someone who's such a big star.
Just describe them kind of physically, what their presence is like on the golf course, how they're different.
Well, Tiger looks like he was born to play some kind of sport. He's tall and he's lean. He's about 6'2", which is very tall for a golfer. Most of the great golfers in history have been under 6 feet tall. Tiger's about 6'2". He's in great shape. He works out all the time. He's gotten bigger through the years physically. He used to be much more lean and wiry, but he's bulked himself up through the years. And there's just not an ounce of fat on him. He looks like he could walk or run from California to New York and not be breathing hard. And again, his demeanor is always very stern. You'll see him smile when he hits a great shot. You might see him smile when he gets lucky. He'll get this sheepish grin on his face. But for the most part, he's very stone-faced throughout a round of golf. Rocco looks like a guy you might meet on the first tee on Saturday morning at your local municipal golf course. He was once very heavy. He's no longer very heavy because he lost a lot of weight after his back surgery. During his rehab, he went from about 5'11", 250 to 5'11", 210 now. So he's in good enough shape, certainly, to play golf. But he always looks a little bit rumpled, even though he wears, you know, very nice clothing on the golf course. And he never stops talking, never stops smiling throughout a round of golf. He may roll his eyes every once in a while when he hits a bad shot, but for the most part, he looks like he's having a good time and looks like the kind of guy you'd love to play 18 holes with and then go have a beer.
So when this Open begins, and Tiger, everybody knows, is the man to beat, even though he'd had knee problems coming in and people weren't sure about that. And Rocco is a guy people know but aren't expecting much from, being the 158th ranked player in the world. Comes in and he's what, leading after the first round? And
no, he was was in third place.
Okay.
He was one shot out of the lead.
In the mix. But then after round two, he was still in the mix, right?
Right. He was in second place at that point.
All right. Just talk a little bit about kind of how you and the media, what he was like, kind of what that felt like as you talked to him about.
Well, everybody is very happy in the media when a guy like Rocco is on the leaderboard, because you want an excuse to talk to someone like him, because he's what's known as a good talker. He's a storyteller. He has a sense of humor. He enjoys spending time with the media. Most players, at best, tolerate the media. Rocco enjoys the media. When they say to Rocco, you're wanted in the interview room, he's happy about it. Most guys are like, oh, God, where is it? How far do I have to traipse to get there? Things like that. So when Rocco was in contention, it gave everybody, at the very least first couple of days, I think Rocco was probably everybody's sidebar. The lead was still going to be, how was Tiger Woods doing? What was the matchup like with Tiger Woods and Phil Mickelson playing together in the first two rounds, which had never been done before, the two top players in the world being paired in the same threesome? and the leaders themselves. So I think the first 2 days, Rocco was kind of a good sidebar for everybody, a guy who'd battled injuries, who'd had to qualify to get in, who had good stories to tell. But I don't think anybody was expecting that late Sunday afternoon he was still going to be the story.
After 3 rounds of the tournament, there's, of course, 4 rounds, and the third round finishes on Saturday. Tiger was ahead by a stroke, is that right?
Correct.
Right. What's his record when he enters the last day of a major ahead by a stroke?
14-0 when he is in the lead. He has never lost a lead at a major championship, and that's a stat that, you know, crops up, obviously, whenever he leads. He rolled in a very long putt, an eagle putt, which is 2 under par on a hole. At the 18th hole, he made a 3 on a par 5 hole, and that jumped him over Lee Westwood, who was in second place at the time. Rocco was 2 shots back.
And that was on the third round on Saturday, right?
This is at the end of the third round, mm-hmm. into the lead. And the first thing the announcers on NBC, Dan Hicks and Johnny Miller, said, Tiger Woods, 13-0, has never lost the lead in a major championship, and he will take the lead into the final round of tomorrow's U.S. Open.
So there we are, that Sunday, and you got Tiger Woods, the best in the world, and Rocco Mediate, and everybody knows that nobody beats Tiger when he has a lead. Give us a feel for what people saw that day. What was Rocco like? How did he behave? How did he win people's hearts?
Well, I think it was a 2-day process of Rocco winning people's hearts. Again, you go into Sunday, as you said, Tiger Woods is leading. So most people expect he's going to win. In fact, people were probably expecting he'd win by 3 or 4. Because he had played progressively better Thursday, Friday, Saturday. And Lee Westwood, who's a very good player from Europe who never won a major, was chasing him. Rocco was chasing him. A couple others were a few shots further back, but really not within hailing distance. And what happened that day was Tiger, who struggled all week on the first hole at Torrey Pines, which was the club where they were playing, made a double bogey on the first hole. And all of a sudden, he brings everybody back into the tournament. Everybody looks up and says, huh, maybe he's human today. Maybe we have a chance. Rocco birdied the second hole. So within 2 holes, he had actually passed Tiger, as had Lee Westwood. And then it became this 3-way battle. And it came down to Tiger having a 12-foot putt, which is far from automatic, that he had to make for birdie to tie Rocco and create the playoff. And by now, the way it is, if there were 50 cameras, I'm making up that number, 25 of them were watching Tiger putt, and 25 of them were watching Rocco watching Tiger putt. And the putt, if you watch it on a replay, Dave, literally went in the hole by an inch. It just skirted the edge of the cup, went around to the back of the cup, and dropped in. And Tiger had one of his reactions that we've all seen where he went completely crazy when the putt went in. And there were Tiger Woods and Rocco Mediate heading to an 18-hole playoff on Monday to decide the U.S. Open.
And on Monday, I mean, it was an amazing story on Monday. I mean, Rocco ends up 3 strokes behind Tiger in the middle, manages to come back and actually take a lead, but then lose. Eventually, Tiger ties him on the last hole. They go to a 1-hole playoff, and Rocco loses the tournament. But it seems to me that he did something that day that no golfer before, including the top-ranked players in the world, had done, which is to catch Tiger on the last day when Tiger had a lead and really give him a run. Why do you think Rocco was able to do this when nobody else?
Well, again, I think it gets back to the fact that he's never been intimidated by Tiger the way so many players are. As I said, they walk on the first tee. He gives them that glare. They know he's not going to talk to them. They know how good he is. And most of them melt. And Rocco's attitude was, I'm not going to let that happen. On the practice tee that day, Rocco was wearing a red shirt. If you follow golf, you know Tiger always wears red on Sunday. That's his Sunday color for winning a tournament. And Rocco woke up Monday morning. He hadn't expected to be playing a 5th day. The only clean shirt he had was red. And he said, I had a choice. I could wear a red shirt, a dirty shirt, or no shirt. I opted for the red one. And he walked out onto the practice tee to warm up, and Tiger came over wearing a red shirt and said, and Tiger uses profanity the way most athletes do in the locker room or in their jock world, and said, nice blanking shirt to Rocco. And Rocco's response was, hey, it's not Sunday. Sundays, your color is red on Sundays. Like, look, I'm not backing down from you. And they were both laughing when they said it. But I think that set a tone for the day. And right from the beginning, it was clear that Rocco was not going to be intimidated. He wasn't going to roll over. Even when he was, as you mentioned, three shots down after 10 holes, there was still a sense that it wasn't over. And Rocco turned it around with three straight birdies, which is extraordinary under those circumstances. Tiger called it one of the great hat tricks he's ever seen. That's usually a hockey term. And as you said, had a one-shot lead again coming to 18. And again, because of the difference in length off the tee, Tiger was able to make a birdie. Rocco made a par, and that set up the sudden death where Tiger won.
What effect do you think the experience had on Rocco? I mean, he'd been on the tour for 24 years. People called him the everyman. But suddenly he had a new level of celebrity. How did it affect him?
Well, I think the first thing he had to do was remind people that he didn't win. Because the way people reacted to him, you would have thought that he had won. The fact that, again, that he wasn't intimidated by Tiger and took him 91 holes and had chances to win both on Sunday and Monday. And he was treated almost as if he had won the tournament. And he had to remind people, look, I'm proud of the way I played. It was a remarkable weekend, but Tiger still won. I think that it reinforced the notion that people had for a long time, people who follow golf, that this is a good guy who, when healthy, is a very good player.
You know, he is such a unique personality, and he's unique on the golf course. I mean, he chatters constantly while most pros sort of maintain this focused silence as they move through a round. And I'm wondering, do you think that kind of sort of down-to-earth, I don't take myself too seriously outlook he has is a secret to his success on the course?
I think in a way it is. And friends of his from boyhood talk about the fact that Rocco is always at his best when he has no hope. This is a guy who was not a very good player in high school, who was recruited by no colleges to play golf, recruited the team that he played on, Florida Southern. He walked on the team, just talked his way onto the team when he got down to Florida Southern. And Rocco is a guy who just he never seems to get down on himself or on the circumstance. And that's what's kept him on tour through all these injuries for all these years. There are a lot of players who, having gone through the back problems, and anybody who's ever had a back problem knows how painful and difficult they can be, would have just walked away by now and said, I don't want to go through the rehab again. I don't want to deal with the pain. I can't play. I can't hit a ball more than 100 yards, which has happened to him during his career. But Rocco has always, kept his attitude. I'm going to find a way. I know I can do it. He's never lost his sense of humor. I think one of the stories that testimony to that is he literally fell flat on his face one morning at Los Angeles Country Club, getting out of his car. His back just went on him, and he went down. And he was lying there, and his friends were inside the clubhouse waiting for him, and he took out his cell phone to call them and say, come and help me. And he remembered that you're not allowed to speak on a cell phone in the parking lot at Los Angeles Country Club. So lying there on his stomach, he texted his friends and said, fell down, can't get up, come get me. And, of course, he told the story on himself after it happened as an example of, what happens when your back goes. But I think that shows you that Rocco always finds a way and never loses his sense of humor about things.
John Feinstein, thanks so much.
Thank you, Dave.
John Feinstein is a regular contributor to Morning Edition, who also writes for The Washington Post and Golf Digest. His book with Rocco Mediate is called Are You Kidding Me? This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. My guest is Rocco Mediate, a professional golfer who captured the hearts of millions of non-golf fans last June when he battled the great Tiger Woods to a thrilling finish at the U.S. Open. Mediate was appealing not just because no one gave him a chance to win, but because he's a likable everyman, a 45-year-old with a paunch and a winning smile who gave the champ the greatest battle of his career. Rocco Mediate has written a memoir and account of the historic U.S. Open with sports journalist John Feinstein. It's called Are You Kidding Me? Well, Rocco Mediate, welcome to Fresh Air. You played sports a lot as a kid, I know. Why did you end up with golf?
Well, I played baseball, I think, back in the, 70s. But and all my buddies, we had a neighborhood with like 10, 12 kids about the same age. So we had a great time, and we all played in the same league. So they all played. We all played together, and then they kind of quit playing and played golf. So I decided to give golf a shot, and we're still here because I didn't have any, the baseball was over. I didn't want to play in high school. I wasn't good enough to play in high school. So who knew?
Now, I want to talk a little bit about what it's like when you're out there on the, playing on the tour. And, mm-hmm. and of course, you have a partner, the caddy, and
right.
he carries the clubs and rakes the sand traps, but he's much more than that. What does a good caddy do?
Oh, yeah. Well, it depends on who you are. Like, some guys just like him to carry the bag, give him numbers, yardages from where they are to the hole, stuff like that. I like Matthew, who caddies for me. He's all my caddies over 24 years I've been on this tour. I've had maybe five different guys, which isn't a lot, actually. I like them to be involved, and I like to talk, and I like to, it's just, I'm only concentrating for about, 4 or 5 seconds over each shot. So it's not like I have a lot to do. So I like to keep busy. They do everything. I mean, they keep you calm. The good ones keep you calm, and the good ones tell you to, if you're complaining and whining and, oh, this is not right and this can't happen to me, so, which we all do. He kind of puts you back in your place. He should. I mean, a good one isn't, one thing Pete Bender, who caddied for me for years, who caddied for Norman and Watkins, and now he's caddying for Aaron Baddeley. Pete never let me get away with childish things because he's seen them all. So he got in my face, and it's good. One thing he said is you shouldn't ever be afraid as a caddy to be fired. Uh-huh. A lot of guys are.
And what kind of childish things would he?
Well,
call
you know what I mean. It's just like, that's a bad break, or that ball should have went here. Blah blah blah. It's just I vent everything. I don't keep anything inside me. It all comes out. And, it may sound negative, but negativity in my mind fuels me, I guess you could say. It's like I always try to prove myself wrong when I say something like, oh, my God, I can't believe I did that, or I shouldn't be here, or this is ridiculous, stuff like that. We all do it, whether it's inside, internal or I say it. And, Matthew's done a good job so far of keeping me where I need to be.
Now, the other thing that happens, of course, in a golf tournament is that you're playing with other guys, two or three, mm-hmm. depending on the day of the tournament. And right. you both hit, or you three of you hit, and then you walk down the fairway, which means you got a lot of time to talk if you want to, but a lot of players don't. Now, right. Is that because they're concentrating or because they want to psych you out? What's going on there?
No, there's the psyching out part doesn't really – as far as I'm concerned, there's nothing that can psych me out except for me. no one else right. can affect anything that I do, nobody. So – and that's how it should be. There's nothing that can stop me from doing what I want to do on the golf course unless I do it myself. But, I talk a lot going down. I'll talk to fans. I'll talk to Matthew. I'll talk to the players. Depends on who you're playing with.
Yeah.
I'm not going to get in there and bother people just because I don't do that. I don't change my game for anybody or change the way I play for anybody. But if I can tell people don't want to talk, I don't bother with the guys I'm playing with as far as talking. But, their caddies always talk a lot, and I keep busy. But some guys just don't.
Yeah, no,
they don't
no,
say anything.
Right. I mean, people can see you're walking down the fairway just chattering away. And what are you talking about? You're talking about the weather? You're talking about where you're going to have dinner?
Who knows? All that stuff. Weather, dinner. What'd you do last night, Matthew? You're just trying to figure something out. Talk about how you're feeling, what you felt. I'll talk about the shot sometimes or the club I hit or whatever, just the breaks and stuff like that. But there's nothing. It's really not rocket science out there. If people knew what we really talked about sometimes, they'd be shocked.
You've had, by any measure, a successful, career on the pro tour. But mm-hmm. at times you have really struggled with back problems.
Oh, boy. Yes, I have.
Describe a couple of the really tough moments there for us. I mean, like in July of 2007, I mean, just a year before you the famous U.S. Open, you –
Yeah, it all started in 94, 93 actually. The end of 93, I had a disc blow in my L1-2 disc. L2-3 kind of fractured, herniated and went crazy. And I had surgery in 94, and I didn't know if I'd ever play again. Went through rehab, blah, blah, blah. Came back out, got my card. I still had my card, but I had to go do something crazy to get it back, and I did. And then it was good for 4 or 5 years. And then, the mid-2000s, like, 3, 4, and 5, I was in bad shape.
And when you say get your card, you mean the card?
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry, yeah.
The player's card. Tour, right, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's what we call it. It's just your privilege is back. If you don't finish in the top 125, you're out. You got to go back to school, tour school, which is a 6-round tournament. you play. They play every year, and they take 25 guys, I think, now. Something like that. 25 guys out of a couple of hundred to get to play the next year. So it's a great job if you can get it, but it's a tough interview because you're interviewed every year. You have to play good or you're gone. So, and I love that part about my sport. But it was really bad there in the mid-2000s, I guess you would say. I had a great, pretty good year. And I think my best year was 02, I believe. I'm not exactly sure. Then 03 was okay. Then 04, 05, and 06, I was in bad shape. I my back went crazy, and I couldn't play much. And when I did, it was terrible. And the Masters in 06 is when it really went sideways. And it blew out on the back nine on the Sunday. I had the lead going into – well, I think I was one out of the lead or tied for the lead going to the back nine. I almost couldn't finish. And that was pretty bad. And then 2007 is when I met Cindy Hofman, who's a physical therapist, and she fixed me.
So the tournament's 4 days, around Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And after 3 days, Tiger has finally taken the lead by, I think, one stroke, right?
Right.
And his record in major tournaments where he has led going into the last day, 13 times he's started the last day leading and has won all 13 times. So,
right. Mm-hmm.
So people tend to kind of think it's over then. Now, the interesting thing that it's hard when I look back at this to remember that you and Tiger were not actually playing together on that last day.
No, he was
me. You were in the group in front of him. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
But talk a little bit about what it's like to play around Tiger on the last day of a big tournament. What are there certain are there special distractions?
The only distractions I have are the ones I create. The people I love. I love the noise. I love the enclosedness. I like the people on the tee. I like all that stuff. I like that excitement. It's. I wish I could do it every week, but I can't.
You mean the thousands of people who were there to see
thousands
Tiger
of people,
and
right?
Warren,
well, there's
right?
Right. They're to see all of us, really, yeah. Especially yeah. On the last day, and they want to see him go. They want to see, you know, like you said, he's won 13 in a row, but there's always a first time for everything, and that's what I was thinking. I'm like, I want to knock this guy off somehow. I know I can. I'm playing good enough to do it because it's an open course. I know what's going to win, and I knew if I was par or better on by the end of the week that I was probably going to win, and unfortunately, it was a tie, but I knew what I had to do, and I knew what, you know, he still has to do it, too. It's not as easy just because he's who he is. He still has to perform, which he does. He's done better than anybody that ever played, so... It's no different to me when he's in the field or not. I'd rather have that challenge and say that I beat the best when I, you know, if I did. I mean, I won the Phoenix Open in 99 playing with him the last two rounds in the same group with me, and I won that. I'll never forget that because he was the number one ranked player in the world. He, you know, and that's just something I can always tell my children, and I love that fact. And I wanted that again a year ago, but I just about got it. I mean, I didn't quite get it, but it doesn't affect me. It doesn't scare me. It doesn't make me nervous. None of that stuff. I just want to beat him somehow.
All right. So on the last day of this tournament, where everybody knows that nobody can get ahead of Tiger if he started the day ahead, you did. I mean, you played mm-hmm. well, and with one hole to go for each of them, you had a one-stroke lead, and it was at some point in this that the TV commentator Johnny Miller, the former golfer, said something like Rocco looks more like Tiger's pool boy than a U.S. Open champion, and it generated some controversy. And
right.
How'd you feel about that?
I didn't care. I thought it was funny. Johnny is a buddy of mine, and Johnny shoots from the hip too, but He just says those things sometimes. I was the first call I got on. He was the first call I got on Tuesday morning was from him to apologize. Said, "I think I got myself in trouble. What do you think?" And I said, "I'm fine."
You took it as a compliment?
No, well, I didn't really take it as anything. You know, I'm like, it's no big deal. He's just how it is. I mean, you know, Tiger's pedigree. I'm not. Those things happen, and you know, a lot of times, obviously, it didn't happen. The amazing thing didn't happen. I did not win the golf tournament, but. There would have been a lot more stories written like that if I did.
All right. So despite Tiger being three strokes ahead on this playoff, mm-hmm. you play well, you come up, and again, on the last hole, have a one-stroke lead. And again,
right.
Tiger manages a birdie. So you're tied again and go to a one-hole playoff, and finally Tiger wins.
Right.
What did the two of you say to each other at the end of it?
Well, you know, I just went over, and after I just missed that par putt to tie, and I walked over, and he just kind of had his hand out, and I just kind of hugged him, and I don't want any part of a handshake. I just kind of hugged him, and he said, "Great fight," and I said, "You too," and that was it.
Yeah,
there was nothing really much to say. It was a long day and a long week, and It was just a very emotional. Roger Maltby and Mark Rolfing were taken back so much because it was so emotional. You know, they're the on-course announcers for us. Roger was following, talking with Tiger, and Mark was talking with me, so following me. So it was just an emotional. Everybody couldn't believe how it turned out because in all, it was over after 10 holes. Everyone thought, except for me. Right. Everybody thought it was over. The whole world said, this is ridiculous, I'm sure, but it became not ridiculous. I knew that if I could do what I had to do, I could beat him. And when I walked to 16 tee box, one ahead, that was exactly where I wanted to be. I wasn't surprised, shocked, worried. I just said, if I do my job the next three holes, it's mine.
Well, you know, Tiger is known for getting big crowds and adoring crowds. But in this tournament, where you're the guy, the one they call every man, the guy who came in, not even one of the top 100 golfers in the world, and takes him a place that no other player ever has on a last day. How did the crowd react to you? What did you feel from them?
Oh, it was total. They were totally me that day. They were very good with both of us, but the screams and the name, the scream and the name, and it was so loud. And they just thought they were going to see something that was never done before, and they enjoyed that. No, you know, they everybody loves Tiger, believe me. But in this instance, they were crazy. It was cool. It was one of the coolest. I'll never see anything like it before, no matter what I do. 30,000 people following two people. I mean, the 18th grandstand was full at 7 o'clock in the morning. We didn't get there till after 2 o'clock, after 1 o'clock. So it was amazing. It was amazing.
Well, Rocco Mediate, good luck on the tour, and thanks so much for speaking with us.
You got it, my friend. Take care.
Rocco Mediate's book with John Feinstein is called "Are You Kidding Me?" Today we continue with Terry's conversation with our critic at large, John Powers, about this year's Cannes Film Festival that ended on Sunday. John is also film critic for Vogue.
I want to start by asking you about Quentin Tarantino's new film. Tarantino's new film is a World War II film called Inglourious Basterds. And from what I was reading, it kept seeming like it was really expensive and it kept being postponed and maybe re-edited. And I was thinking, oh, it's probably a real problem film. But it seemed to be really popular at Cannes. Tell us about the movie.
Inglourious Basterds was probably the hottest ticket of the festival. Its first screening, you know, anywhere was at 8:30 in the morning, and people were lining up at 7 in the morning to see a World War II film by Quentin Tarantino. And no one knew quite what to expect, and there was much talk that it was insanely violent and all sorts of things. In fact, it's a very amusing film. What Tarantino has done, I think, is take us back to a different era. If you look at the history of World War II movies, you know, the ones during World War II were largely very serious because they were fighting World War II. That switched a bit in the 60s, where you actually had things like The Great Escape or The Dirty Dozen, where World War II became a backdrop for action and excitement. And that might have hit some sort of peak probably in that silly sitcom Hogan's Heroes, where a prisoner of war camp in World War II is the place where you have a sitcom. In the 80s, things got serious again. You know, Steven Spielberg in particular was the person trying to take people back to the serious appreciation of World War II, both in Schindler's List and its handling of the Holocaust, and then later in his film Saving Private Ryan, which was going to show us what it was really like to be, you know, at the D-Day invasion. Tarantino takes us back to the 60s with the films that are more or less romps or capers set during the backdrop of World War II. And the story basically follows three major characters. One of them is a young Jewish woman whose family's been murdered. One is the evil Nazi, beautifully played by the guy who won Best Actor, a guy named Christoph Waltz. The evil Nazi. And the third one is Brad Pitt's character, who leads a group of guys called Inglourious Basterds, who basically go around slaughtering Nazis. And these three people eventually come together at a movie theater in Paris for a big climax. The film, from the beginning, is extremely funny, very, very entertaining. Tarantino is a wonderful writer of scenes. And almost every scene is filled with sharp dialogue and good acting and good jokes. I don't think the film adds up to very much. It's a bit of a romp in the way that something like The Great Escape is a romp. But in fact, as you're watching, it's a really, really good time. And it's so far away from being serious about World War II that you don't feel offended by the silliness and violence in the way that you would have if Tarantino was trying to make a serious World War II movie like Saving Private Ryan.
Vampires are making a really big comeback in American popular culture. There's a South Korean film about vampires that showed at the Cannes Film Festival. Tell us about that one.
The film is called Thirst. It's by a guy named Park Chan-wook, who people might know from a film called Old Boy. The film's coming out later this summer, and so it's very seeable.
Coming out in the States?
It has – in the States, yes. It has one of the great – I think one of the great premises, I think, for a vampire film I've ever seen, which is that it's about a South Korean priest who, because he loves humanity, goes off to a special clinic where they're doing medical research, and he gives his body up to medical research. The problem is that he gets a disease that turns him into a vampire. So you have a guy who goes from metaphorically drinking the blood of Christ to a creature who now must drink the blood of human beings. But although he's a vampire who must drink the blood of human beings, he still has the mentality of a priest who's trying to behave well in the world. And the film is at once spooky and tender and very, very comic. It races out of control at the ending. I think it gets too bloody and nuts for my taste, although a lot of people really loved it. But the setup really is this brilliant setup of what happens when you get a vampire who knows he shouldn't be a vampire, who's morally opposed to killing people, all the ways in which he tries to keep going, the ways of keeping alive, the ways of doing the right and decent thing, while at the same time knowing that you actually have to drink blood to survive.
That sounds really interesting.
It's a very interesting film, yeah.
Let's get back to Terry's conversation with our critic at large, John Powers. He's just returned from the Cannes Film Festival.
John, what was your biggest disappointment at the Cannes Film Festival?
Oh, I think many people's biggest disappointment, including mine, was Taking Woodstock, the Ang Lee film, which is clearly designed to commemorate Woodstock, which happened 40 years ago. And it's a film that stars Dimitri Martin as one of the guys who basically set up the Woodstock thing. And he's a more or less young man who's trapped with his parents, who are running a deadbeat hotel in and around Woodstock. And the film is designed to offer you this vision of that era. And instead, what happens is it becomes something of a Neil Simon play with an overbearing, greedy Jewish mom and a cliché Vietnam vet played by Emile Hirsch. And it's a film that promised to give you so much texture of life in the 60s. And instead, what happens is that it turns into a bit of a parody of what about Woodstock in that period was like. That said, it has incredibly great production design. I think anyone who watches the film and who lived through that period will think, wow, boy, the costumes are really perfect. Everything looks exactly right. You know, at that level, it's a great film. But it's just a very, very wan film. You want a film about this great cultural event to have real oomph, but instead it winds up being this small, even kind of dinky film that doesn't make you feel anything. When, of course, what you want from Woodstock is something that makes you feel something, even if it's disapproval or nostalgia or regret. This film is so small that it doesn't do it. I mean, I think that almost everybody who saw it from America didn't like it. I suspected, because it's not a very good film, that one reason why Cannes put it in the competition this year was that they had turned down Brokeback Mountain and got a lot of grief for it. So I think this time they thought, well, we're not going to make the same mistake twice, and they put this one in, and this is probably one that shouldn't have been in the festival. Very amiable film, fun to watch, just not very good at all.
So one of the movies at Cannes is a movie from Romania that was masterminded by the same filmmaker who made a film that was very popular in art houses in the United States a couple of years ago called 4 Months, 3 Weeks, and 2 Days, and it was about a woman trying to get an abortion during a time that it was very illegal under the dictator Nicolae Ceausescu in Romania. So this film, too, is about life under Ceausescu, life under dictatorship. Tell us about the movie.
Well, it's called Tales of the Golden Age, ironically enough. And the film is 5 stories about life in the Ceausescu era. And they're 5 very different tales. And each one has a sort of ironic twist or a melancholy twist about life during that time. So the first one shows a bunch of people more or less preparing for Ceausescu's brief arrival in their village, where they're getting phone calls from Ceausescu's front people saying, Ceausescu didn't like the animals lining the road in the last place he was. Switch to sheep. And so you basically watch them creating a reality for the dictator. And at the end of that particular episode, everybody in the town winds up on a whirligig at the local thing, and they realize that even the guy who started the whirligig is on the whirligig. So they're all spinning around with no way of getting off, which becomes a metaphor for what life was like there. Over the next four episodes, you get different aspects of life in Ceausescu's Romania. You know, one of the stories is about a guy whose job it is to doctor photos in the paper so that Ceausescu looks taller than the foreign dignitaries who come to visit. One of the stories is about a family in Bucharest who has a friend who's willing to give them a pig, but the problem is they have to slaughter the pig in their own apartment. And to make that even harder, they have to slaughter the pig in their own apartment without it being able to squeal, because as soon as it squeals, all the neighbors will come and demand parts of the pig or they'll be turned into the police. So it's a series of crazy episodes and vignettes that capture the absurdity and melancholy of a country that's completely under the control of one man. And that man makes life miserable, and everybody's at once scared and hustling at every moment trying to keep alive. It's a really, really good film, and it's just the latest film from that most unlikely of film hotspots, Romania. I mean, if you'd told me 10 years ago that almost every year when I talked to you, Terry, that I'd come back saying one of the very best things at Cannes was a film from Romania, I wouldn't have believed it. And now everyone knows it, you know, that Romanian films are hot, believe it or not.
Well, John, thanks for talking with us about the Cannes Film Festival. It's always good to talk with you.
It was my pleasure. Thanks.
John Powers is Fresh Air's critic at large and film critic for Vogue. You can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org.